The Railroad, A Railroad Story, March 26, 1856. Something was going to happen at Ellicott's Mills. Such a strange thing, too. Little Francis Ellicott heard about it every day, for all the people were talking of nothing but the new railroad. Not one of them had ever seen a railroad, but it had been settled that they were to have one, coming from Baltimore straight out to Ellicott's Mills, a distance of 13 miles. Then the road was to go on from the Patapsco Valley into the Potomac Valley at Point of Rocks. And then, most wonderful of all, it was to wind its way over the mountains to the Ohio River. The road was to be called the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, though it would be a long time before rails could be run all the way through to the Ohio River. Francis heard many a dismal prediction, but not one of them dampened his enthusiasm. "The wheels of the coaches are to run on two iron rails made fast to the ground," his grandfather told him, "and the builders expect one horse to be able to do the work of 10 on the ordinary turnpike road. They will never get across the mountains, never," concluded the old gentleman, solemnly shaking his head. Now, Francis knew a good deal about traveling by boat, a little about traveling on horseback, and a very little about traveling by coach. But how could he know anything about a railroad? The first railroad built in America was not then 2 years old and was way up north in Massachusetts. Two others had been built before the Baltimore and Ohio, but all three were used for hauling granite or coal. This, the fourth road built in the country, was intended for general transportation. When Francis learned that this high-sounding phrase meant that the cars were to carry passengers as well as freight, he shouted to think what fun it would be to see a car filled with ladies and gentlemen rolling along on two narrow rails faster than a coach could travel on the broad turnpike. He did not dream that anything better than horses could be found to draw the cars, nor, in fact, did the men who planned the road, and the picture he made for himself was of a string of coaches fastened together, all drawn along that queer little track by a prancing horse. It was not so very long before Francis realized something very like his vision. On the 4th of July, 1828, the railroad was begun, and in the spring of 1830, the double track which had been laid as far as the mills was ready for use. Then a notice was given that the line would be open to the public on the 24th of May, and that the fare to Ellicott's Mills in return would be 75 cents. On the appointed morning, Francis, with many others, eagerly waited for the first passenger train. When at length a state horse came trotting along, drawing after him the small but well-filled cars, Francis was sorely disappointed. What did it matter, after all, whether the horse drew the coach on a track or along the turnpike? Everything about the train was disappointing, except the amount of noise which the cars made on the rail of combined stone and iron which was laid in those days. From that time, Francis lost his interest in the railroad, until one morning in the summer something happened that was not a bit disappointing. At breakfast, Mr. Ellicott said, "There is something coming on the railroad today, my son, that you will wish to see." Francis was surprised that his father should show so much interest in the stupid railroad, for it seemed as if even the older people must know that there had been nothing on the road for months that was worth seeing. "I do not know when it will reach here, but we will be on the watch at the time it is expected, for I wish very much to see the wonderful device myself," added Mr. Ellicott. "What is it, father?" asked Francis. "What they call a locomotive." "A locomotive?" repeated Francis, wonderingly. "Yes, a machine to take the place of horses in drawing the cars," answered his father. "Mr. Peter Cooper has one built, and he is to try it today. Stockton and Stokes, I hear, will send out their very best horse, the big gray that you admire so much, for a race with the locomotive. The machine is to draw a car, and the gray is to draw another, running on the second track." This was news indeed. Long before the time set for the locomotive to leave Baltimore, Francis was watching the track. He fully expected to see only the powerful horse with his car flying down the second track. The strange proprietor's horse, Francis was sure, was the finest in the world. Surely no new fangled machine could hold its own with that marvel of strength and speed. The time dragged, until at last Francis saw approaching not the gallant gray, but the first locomotive in America that had drawn a passenger coach. Francis could never tell afterward just what his picture of a locomotive had been, something rather like a horse, perhaps, but certainly nothing like that queer little black machine about as large as a good-sized chaise. "What makes it go?" he asked his father in utter amazement. "Steam," was his father's unsatisfactory answer. Why steam should be able to move a whole train, Francis could not understand. Steam never made the tea kettle go running over the top of the stove. Why should it move this strange black object along the track? It was all a mystery, but the locomotive certainly moved at a rapid rate, drawing behind it a car filled with directors of the railroad and their friends. Francis forgot about the gray horse and his curiosity to see the locomotive. He walked down to the end of the line with his father, where a great number of people were crowding around the little engine as it came to a stop at the close of the first half of its trial trip. The little train had come around the curves at the rate of 15 miles an hour, and at its greatest speed had covered 18 miles an hour. It had been predicted that people could not endure being whirled along at what was called such terrific velocity. But here were the directors, safe and sound, and, to all appearances, unusually happy. Everybody in the party congratulated Mr. Cooper. One gentleman showed Mr. Ellicott a memorandum book in which he had written his address and several connected sentences when they were traveling at the highest speed. "A revolution has begun," this man declared. "Horsepower is doomed." "Old Erasmus Darwin was nearer right than people thought," said a director, "when he wrote 50 years ago, 'Soon shall thy arm, unconquered steam, afar drag the slow barge or drive the rapid car.'" Francis looked at the locomotive first on one side and then on the other. This strange machine filled him with wonder. And after all, a boy of today would be filled with wonder at seeing such a locomotive, though for different reasons. He would be astonished to see that the whole engine weighed only about 1 ton, that it had only 4 wheels, and most of all that its boiler, which was about as large as a flour barrel, stood up straight in the air instead of lying on its side as in the engine of today. Francis caught the enthusiasm of the party and decided then and there to be a railroad man. All his way home, after the little train had started back to the city, he was trying to decide whether he would rather drive the Tom Thumb, as Mr. Cooper called the little engine, or be a director and ride in a passenger coach at the terrific speed of 18 miles an hour. Francis was sitting on the porch at home before he thought of the gray horse. "Didn't the horse come?" he asked his father. "One of the gentlemen told me," answered his father, "that they expected to meet him somewhere on the return and to race from there to town." The next day Francis heard about the race. It seemed that the horse did meet the returning engine at the relay house where the race began. While the engine was getting up steam, the horse gained upon it, and he was perhaps a quarter of a mile ahead when the excitement began. This is the story of the race as told by Mr. Latrobe, one of the members of the party. The safety valve began to scream and the engine began to gain. The pace increased. The passenger shouted. The engine gained on the horse. Soon it lapped him. The silk was plied. The race was neck and neck, nose in nose. Then the engine passed the horse and a great hurrah hailed the victory. But it was not repeated, for just at this time, when the gray's master was about giving up, the band which drove the pulley, which drove the blower, slipped from the drum, the safety valve ceased to scream, and the engine began to wheeze and pant. In vain Mr. Cooper, who was his own engine man and fireman, lacerated his hands in attempting to replace the band upon the wheel. In vain he tried to urge the fire with lightwood. The horse gained on the machine and passed it, and although the band was presently replaced, the horse was too far ahead to be overtaken and came in the winner of the race. Although the horse reached town first, the victory really belonged to the locomotive. Everybody realized this fact, and there were no more trials of speed between horse and steam power. It was only a little more than a year afterwards that the Baltimore and Ohio Railway gave up the use of horses altogether. Soon after this trial trip on the Baltimore and Ohio, a train made up of a locomotive and three passenger coaches was seen on a New York railroad, the coaches still built like stage coaches, each carrying 9 people inside and 6 outside. In a few years more, locomotives were in use in all parts of the country then settled. In 1840, there were about 3,000 miles of track in the country. When Francis Ellicott visited the Centennial in 1876, he saw displayed there by the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad a locomotive weighing 50 tons. He thought of the Tom Thumb and laughed. "The steam locomotive has about reached its limit," he said to himself. His son, Francis Ellicott Jr., saw in St. Louis at the Great Exposition in 1904 a freight engine displayed by the same Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, which weighed 239 tons. While contrasting the monster with his father's picture of the Tom Thumb, his eye fell on one of the powerful new electric locomotives not far away. Smiling, he said to himself, with more truth than his father's remark contained, "The steam locomotive has about reached its limit." To think all discovered an error profound, 'tis to take the horizon for Earth's mighty bound. The first transcontinental railroad. When gold was discovered in California, hundreds of thousands of men were eager to find their way thither. Some went by sea, around Cape Horn. Others went by way of the Isthmus of Panama, while many crossed the plains. Whatever route was chosen, there were dangers to be faced. The storms of a perilous passage, the fever-breeding air of the tropics, or the attacks of prowling bands of Indians. Railroad men watched the going and coming of men by these three routes and wished that they might profit by the movement of such a large number of people and their baggage. At first, they said it was impossible to build a railroad across the trackless plains of the West. Then they began to wish they could do it. At last, they decided to attempt the impossible. Some people did no more than talk about the great work to be done. While they talked, others were studying the country, looking for the best route for the road they believed would someday drive out of business the Pony Express and the freight wagons. The expense of building such a road would be so great that the help of the United States government was needed. Congress was therefore asked for assistance, and it was decided to offer the road builders $16,000 in bonds and 10 sections of public land along the line of the road for every mile completed. Later, this subsidy was increased to 20 sections per mile and large amounts in bonds according to the difficulty of the work done. Two companies were organized to do the work of the Central Pacific Railway, which began to build eastward from Sacramento, the capital city of California, and the Union Pacific Railway, which built westward from Council Bluffs, Iowa. Very soon, the new project was called the Overland Route. The name is credited to a San Francisco German who had nothing to do with the railroad. It was his habit to ask every stranger who came to the city during the days of the golden excitement, "Did you come the horn around, the isthmus across, or the land over?" When the railway was begun, it was called the land over route. Very naturally, this was soon changed to the overland route. There were great difficulties in the way of the railway builders. The eastern railways were not completed to Council Bluffs, and all material for the new road had to be taken across country or up the Missouri River. Construction machinery for the western end of the line was shipped round Cape Horn. The first locomotive used for a construction train on the Central Pacific was hauled across country by horses. There were no trees along many miles of the proposed route. Ties, bridge timbers, and material for buildings were carried at great expense for hundreds of miles. It is said that many of the ties had cost as much as $2.50 each by the time they were put in place. But the greatest difficulty was caused by the Indians. At first, the builders of the Union Pacific had no trouble with the Children of the Plains, for they made a treaty with them by which the site of the present city of Omaha was secured. But later, the Indians opposed the progress of the road almost daily. They turned up when they were least expected. They would either shoot at the workmen from ambush or make an open attack on them. They would pull up the surveyor's stakes and burn them. They delighted to burn station buildings. Charles Frederick Carter has told of a party of 10 railroad men who, when they were attacked by Indians, unwisely sought shelter in a clump of sagebrush some 500 feet distant. The sagebrush afforded no protection to the hunted men, but it provided a cover under which the Indians could creep up on them. Before night, the red men had succeeded in killing some of the party. Three only managed to escape in the darkness. The first attempts made by the Indians to stop trains were unsuccessful, for they did not realize the power of a locomotive. Once, 60 braves, 30 on each side of the track, tried to halt a train by stretching a lariat before it. Failure in such attempts led them to take more effective measures. Obstructions were placed on the track. Trains were wrecked, and many men were killed. There were so many attacks on trains that soldiers were detailed to guard the tracks. Frequently, the cunning savages eluded the guards. More than once, however, wreckers were surprised in the midst of their fiendish work. One day, General G.M. Dodge was with his soldiers at Plum Creek, 200 miles west of Omaha, when word reached him that a freight train had been captured a few miles east of that station. An engine was coupled to a car in which volunteers had been crowded, and the scene of the attack was reached before the Indians realized their danger. Few of the Indians escaped. Effective help in protecting the road was given by Major Frank J. Knott, who engaged four companies of Pawnee Indians. With the aid of these scouts, the plans of the Cheyennes and the Sioux were very often discovered in time to warn the laborers of threatened danger. Finally, General Grant led troops into the disputed country and made peace with the Indians. The treaty guaranteed to the railway builders the right to go on with their work. The road was begun early in 1863, but it was May 10, 1869, before the last rail was laid and the last spike was driven. At first, progress was slow, but later the work was done rapidly. The builders of the Central Pacific naturally wished the meeting point to be as far east as possible, and the builders of the Union Pacific were just as eager that it should be as far west as possible, for each mile meant a small fortune from the government. As the two roads came closer together, excitement was great. Newspapers sent their best correspondents to the front, commissioned to prepare picturesque stories of the contest. Every morning, readers watched eagerly for the report of the progress made the day before by the rival builders. And when the news was flashed that at last the Golden Spike had been driven at Promontory, Utah, there was widespread rejoicing. The gap of 1,800 miles had been closed, and at last it was possible to ride by rail from the Atlantic to the Pacific.